saving money on all your electrical needs at Menards. From wire, tools, testers, and more, Southwire is the perfect choice for your next electrical project. They offer innovative products to help you get your project done right. Hurry in today and save big on all Southwire products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
All right, people, Hidden Mentality's back, can you believe it? And not only have I not done a pod in 2 months, I'm doing a solo pod, I know, unbelievable. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate it. But I usually do solo episodes, like a YouTube video where I cut it out, do all the shenanigans, add some cool, effects videos. I mean, I'm not that cool, but I make some transitions just to make it seem more like an actual proper cutout YouTube video. But you know what? I want to challenge myself. No cutting out for the reach today. It's got to be off the dome, off the script, like a general solo pod. So today we're debunking self-improvement myths. Why am I doing that? Well, started the pod a year ago. And even though I haven't done the pod in 2 months, started the pod a year ago because I was into self-improvement. And obviously when you're into self-improvement and you're in that realm, you start hearing all these cliches and tricks and you're like, huh? Let me try those out. And luckily for you guys, I've tried 5 pretty big ones out, and I've got my opinion on it, and we're going to debunk them today. So, like I said before, it's an actual pod today. It's no YouTube shenanigans. It's just me speaking to you, probably my 2 lovely viewers. Hi there, Mom. Hi there, Dad. Lovely to see you. But yeah, so do they work? Let's start with the classic one, the David Goggins style. Waking up at 5 a.m. Does that actually work? To be honest, here's my hot take. I think it's bullshit. I do think it's bullshit. And I'll tell you why. I think there's nothing inherent about waking up at 5 a.m. that makes someone a higher performer in the crowd. You see all these people on Instagram and on social media sitting on their high horse. I wake up at 5 a.m. What are you doing? What is the actual impact of waking up at 5 a.m.? Because I'll tell you what, right? Sophomore year, which was last year when I started the pod, I was waking up at 5 a.m. every day, not because, well, maybe for my ego as well, but because I had class every day at 9. And for me, I go to the gym in the morning no matter what. That's just a me thing. And the gym has to be the first thing. So for my day to work out, I just had to wake up at 5:30. And I tested it out for roughly, I'd say, 100 days, and I think waking up at 5 a.m. itself, there is nothing actually powerful about that 5 a.m. spot. But what I will say, though, that is not bullshit, is the fact that when I had to wake up at 5 a.m., it's not more about the waking up at 5 a.m. that killed me. Obviously, it is a chain sequence, but waking up at 5 a.m. forced me to sleep at 9:39, which then, because I had an alarm set at 9 p.m. almost every day, that means my rest of the day had to fit that exact time. Like, otherwise, I would sleep late and I wouldn't get enough hours of sleep. Because here's the thing. Rish Kurada, he needs his 8 hours of sleep. Otherwise, the man doesn't function. All right? That's why, people know me. Is it very tough for me to function? I mean, it's a very normal thing. I think sleep is one of the most important things. But what I will say is when you set an alarm to sleep at 9:30, you typically need to make sure that the rest of the day is focused around that. So those little stuff that you think, hey, I'm just going to do it later, you kind of like, no, I got to make sure I do it now. So I sleep at 9:30. I go to class. I get all my work done by a certain point. Make sure I have dinner by 7, cook it up, blah, 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 so I go to sleep at 9:30. And that in itself allowed me to be more organized. The 5 a.m. part, I could have chosen a different time. Let's say I chose 6 a.m., 7 a.m., 8 a.m., that schedule, that system that I would still have with that rigidity and organization would still stay intact. It's not about the 5 a.m. itself. It's the fact that I actually set myself a goal of waking up at a certain time, which then forced me to set an alarm to sleep on time. That's the main shift that people make. And I think it's unfair, to be completely honest, because there's some people that are just night owls, and some people are just the early birds. Why does that even work? Night owls and early birds, they're both birds. Anyway, some people are just early birds. Some people just like to stay up in the night. And it's unfair to say, hey, the people that wake up at 5 a.m. are just higher performers. Piss off. That's not possible. I'm the person that functions better in the morning. I'm a horrible functioner at night. My two roommates in New York completely perform very well in the night. That's why, like, when they see me at night, I'm drowsing asleep. Like, I can't function. I can't do any of my work at night. They can do it. So it's tough for me to go, hey, I am a higher performer than you guys, when we're both basically performing the same, but just at different times throughout the day. What I will say, though, is there is part of me that says the 5 a.m. in itself does have a few pros. One is you do get more daylight in itself, even though two people who sleep at different times and are performing the same, the person who wakes up at 5 a.m. is actually inherently in itself getting more daylight and more daytime throughout the day, because when they sleep at 9, it's already darkness. The other guy is getting the same amount of sleep, same amount of health benefits, because I guess the amount of daylight they're getting is less, but they're performing the same, or their organization of their day is the exact same, but they just get less daylight, which I think is actually a bit of a con. I will also say that there is a book called The 5 a.m. Club by Robin Sharma. It's a very famous book, which is actually maybe why this 5 a.m. stigma is so huge. And in the book, I actually haven't read it, but I spoke to one of my podcast guests about it, and the main takeaway he got from the book was you wake up at 5 a.m. because typically that is the time where nothing else is typically going on. Let's say you have a 9-to-5 job. There's not much work or the outside world. Okay, we can get into GOG and stuff where everyone's working around better than you, but the outside world typically isn't functioning at its normal rate at 5 a.m. So that time in itself is that sweet time for you to have your own sanctuary. You get that peace at 5 a.m. where typically if you wake up at 8, you might not be able to have that. And in the book, Robin Sharma talks about this fact that when you have that sanctuary in the morning, that's your time for yourself. And the rest of the day is the time to give for others. And I think that actually does help a lot. When I was waking up at 5 a.m., that time to myself, I love hanging out with people. I get a lot of energy from hanging out with people. But the issue is, as much as the extroverts love hanging out with people and love getting energy from people, there's a certain amount of energy we can give as well. And that energy that we can give is dependent on how much time we have to ourselves. So having that time at 5 a.m. where typically others aren't expecting much from you is perfect, because I am allowed to have my own time. Then I get whenever I woke up at 5, I'd walk to the gym for 30 minutes, go to the gym for an hour, come back 30 minutes, shower, even that entire 3-hour process. Yeah, I'm walking there or going to the gym, I'm still in my own head, in my own zone. So it's nice to at least have that own time for myself. And then once I'm done, once that 9 a.m., 8 a.m., we're going, that's when I feel good about giving time to others. Because realistically, the most, not to be like cringe about it, but the most satisfying part about, at least my life, is when I know that I can like do something for someone else. But at the same time, when I don't have time for myself, it's very hard for me to think about what I need at times as well. So 5 a.m. in itself, I don't think there's much. Like, say, for someone to wake up at 5 a.m. for the sole purpose of flexing, or this egotistical, the performative element of 5 a.m., I think it's complete bullshit. the people that are able to wake up at 8 a.m. but do more work, go do that. There's nothing crazy about waking up at 5 a.m. I will say there are certain pros that I'm out loud saying now. But realistically, as a whole, waking up at 5 a.m., I'm going to say it is bullshit. If you can play your cards right, which I actually think is more about sleeping on time and optimizing for daylight, which 5 a.m. could do, but the overall performative action of waking up at 5 a.m., if you go to bed at 12, why wake up at 5? Just get your 8 hours of sleep. Like, I know there's Instagram gurus telling you to wake up at a certain point. Just get your 8 hours of sleep, all right? It's more that you can plan your day accordingly, and then that will just make your life a lot easier. And if 5 a.m. is the time, then 5 a.m. is the time. Just don't make it just so it's performative. So that's my take on waking up at 5 a.m. The second one, the second self-improvement myth, is journaling. And for me, out of all the five that I'm going to mention today, journaling is the biggest hit. And when I say it's the biggest hit, it's the best one for me that's worked. And if you want me completely honest, I was so far against journaling for the longest amount of time. I only started journaling right when I started this podcast. And there's that classic cliche of journaling where you say, oh, it feels like you're just writing like a 14-year-old girl. Nothing against 14-year-old... Oh, let's... I don't even want to make a joke about that. There's nothing against that in itself, but it's like, it doesn't have to be, hey, I went to school today, and Sally really hurt my feelings. It can be that, but it doesn't have to be that. And I had a conversation with a lovely friend of mine, a mentor of mine, Sean Pritchard, and he basically laid it out saying, journaling is something he does every day. And I was like, hold on, why is that happening? I thought it was just for like that teenage era. But then he was like, look, Rish, I'll be honest. When I want you to go into the new year, I want you to just journal every day in the morning. Let's see how that goes. So took that on pretty strongly, journaled for 100 days. And what I will say is it is more helpful than people think, but not as life-changing as maybe I'm making it out to be, but it is something that I would highly recommend. In the 100 days of journaling, I realized that for chronic overthinkers like me or chronic overanalyzers of any situation, journaling something out and being able to almost read it back can in itself make you realize how small certain issues are. It's also... It's almost like a progress tracker as well, because now the best part of journaling that I can take back is when Rish 2024 is journaling, I'm like now Rish Karada in Australia in 2025 is reaping the benefits, because we sometimes underrate ourselves because we're never able to properly see the progress we make even in a week or in a month or in a year. But when we're able to journal our thoughts down, those thoughts are resonant or representative of a certain point in your life. It's hard to, as me now, to retrace my thoughts back in 2024, but because I wrote them down, those are permanently written on my book. So now when I read them back, I'm like, wow. I'm not for me to say we shouldn't have big dreams or big aspirations, but there's certain points where, like, you can take a lot of satisfaction knowing that you're in a better place than you were at certain points. Like, the issues that I was having back then, not that they were deep, but were a lot... I would not want those issues now. Because at one point, I remember I was journaling a month before I started the podcast, and it was like, oh, what am I going to do? I feel like I'm not doing much. Do I start a business? And I'm like, there's literally my business ideas written down, and I was going through it. And it's like, you can look back at it now, I'm like, damn. Like, even though my podcast is at 160 subs, my highest viewed video is a K, which is gas-ish, kind of. Not. Now, you know what? It is gas a bit. But it's like, damn, like, maybe in the viewership, it's not what I expected. But at the same time, I've got something in itself that I've, at least I'm working towards something. And sometimes we struggle to give ourselves credit for those little things. And I think journaling allows to do that. I mean, it's hard for me to look at, like, saying, hey, there's pros and cons, because all I low-key see is pros. I would give cons if I was here saying journaling will change your life for 99 times or better. But I don't see any negatives with doing it. I think it's a brilliant thing in itself. I think journaling allows you to track your progress in a way where sometimes we are our biggest critics, but and it's weird because we're our biggest critics. And then when it comes to compliments or areas of times where we need satisfaction, that's where we struggle to find the source, or we struggle to find it within ourselves. So it's all, and it's lovely when other people say to ourselves, I mean, it's the best feeling in the world when other people give us a compliment, but there's something very intrinsically satisfying about knowing that you've done something on your own and you're able to give yourself credit for that. It's just very nice to have that. And then beyond the fact that journaling is a progress tracker, it's almost a, this is where I'm going to get into the teenage stuff, like that teenage stigma. It is a very, very nice way to get out your frustrations, because I have this kind of thing that I follow, which is like, I try not to hold grudges for other people or myself. The myself part is the hardest, but I try not to hold grudges for other people, because there's no point in wasting time and energy on something, which is, and I did this episode with Will Keep It Real. I think it was episode 10 or 11, one of them. And one thing, I try to take one thing out of each episode I record. The biggest thing I took from that episode was this idea of forgiveness. Because forgiveness for me used to be about, oh, just forgetting what someone did, and just like, or even yourself, forgetting what you did and just treating someone the same. Forgiveness is almost like a self thing for me now. Not everyone needs to agree with this, but when I forgive someone, it's not like, hey, I don't remember what you did anymore. It's more just like, hey, I remember what you did, but on my side, I don't have the time and energy to deal with that anymore. I accept it for what it is. It's more like, I forgive you is more like, a sense of, I no longer have anger for it. I'm no longer going to spend my own time dealing with it, because it's out of my grasp. And I think that acceptance is what forgiveness is. The reason I bring that up is I think journaling allows that forgiveness to occur at a faster rate or a more efficient rate. Because it's all well and good showing your frustrations out on someone, but at the end of the day, it's what are you doing? You're just bringing on hate on this world for no apparent reason. Not to get like deep, but what's the point? And there's something satisfying getting your frustration. I've used the word satisfying a lot, so you know, maybe I need to expand on the vocabulary. This is why I need to do more solo pods. Who knows? But there's something very fulfilling about getting your frustrations out on a piece of paper, when you don't want to chat shit about or to someone else who may judge you for it. Because realistically, the only person that can judge you for chatting shit when you're on a piece of paper is yourself. And what I've actually realized is sometimes when you get that out on a piece of paper, two things can happen. One thing is you're like, damn, thank God I didn't say that to someone else. Like, fucking hell, thank shit for that. And the second one is, how ridiculous is that? Like, am I really holding a grudge? I was going to hold a grudge over for that. Like, the fact that you can visualize what you're getting angry for allows you to start coping and accepting it. And I forgot what book I read this in, but I remember Abe Lincoln, and for my fellow people who are not American, you know, like, not patriots, Abe Lincoln is an American president during the Civil War. I remember Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, and especially in wartime, whenever his commander, I think one of the times his commander like fluffed off a battle somewhere, he screwed up a battle somewhere, some idiotic move, right? Abe would write countless letters with rage, everything this man has done wrong. Like this commander that has screwed up Lincoln's plan in war, he would write it out with complete, I don't even know what slurs he was. This guy was going crazy. He was writing it everything down. And I remember after Lincoln passed, they found these letters, but they were never sent. The people that these letters were responding to, at least, or supposed to be sent to, were never sent by Lincoln. And Lincoln didn't write these letters in order to actually to make the other person feel bad. It was more to almost visualize what it would be like. Because he knew that, and realistically, what good is he going to get out of making else someone feel bad for his own frustrations? Because you might get satisfaction from it in the short term, but realistically, you're still going to be coping and handling that anger. Just because it sometimes it hurts when the person that's hurt you gets over it quicker than you. So the best way to almost react to someone hurting you can just be accepting it yourself. So yeah, that's my main two things with journaling. It's a progress tracker. You can mention your goals, your aspirations, even your current status, which I think everyone should do. I treat journaling now as something I do now and then. I probably should go back to it now that I'm saying it every day, just because maybe reaching 2026, would be then able to see how he was doing, and then I can give myself credit for back then. But yeah, you can mention your goals, your triggers. You can see how you were half a year ago, a year ago, even a month ago. And yeah, because of that, you're allowed to then start rating yourself more. And I think the biggest critic we have is ourselves. So try to take away that critic by being able to give yourself credit. And I think journaling does that. And obviously the second one is getting rid of your frustrations. So yeah, there's the second one debunked. All right, journaling top tier. Third one, oh, this is interesting. I can't lie. This is a good one. Reading a book every week. This is one of those ones where I've got notes on it. And in my notes, I've got... I'm still stuck. So I'll give you my thoughts on it. And whoever wants to agree can agree with the certain parts. You can disagree with the certain parts. 2025, that first 5 months that I started Hidden Mentality, the podcast itself, I was reading a book every week. And I'm not a fiction reader, unfortunately. I'm not the guy that can read 50 Shades of Grey and call it a day. Like, I just don't like that because I only read shit that I can try to apply to my life. That's just like, I wish I wasn't a noveler, but like, you know that the when we have those Harkness discussions in English class and little Sally in the corner is like, oh, the character's so profound because she ate a pasta and that like foreshadows. I'm like, no, shut up, Sally. It's not like that. That's why I'm not a big fan of novels. I've read The Alchemist. That's a good one. But anyway, I was saying, I read a book every week. Almost like self-improvement books, the Atomic Habits, whether it was a business book, maybe 0 to 1, the Atomic Habits, 0 to 1, obviously Tiny Experiments that I read, see, now this is embarrassing, because I read a book every week, and I can't remember them, but anyway, read a good amount. I'm trying to give one more book that I read, How to Win Friends and Influence People, brilliant book, love that one. Signs of Happiness, You Thrive, read that one as well. It's good, and what I've realized is, reading a book every week, say similarly waking up at 5 a.m., we should not be doing it performatively, because realistically, if we're not applying, especially, I'm going to speak from the context of self-improvement books and non-fiction, not novels, because novels are different, maybe different, but they can apply in this, some parts. If you're not applying what you're learning from the books, realistically, then what's the big difference other than the dopamine hit compared to doom scrolling? You're basically doom scrolling all this self-improvement garbage without actually applying it. It's just mental masturbation. There's nothing actually being learned there. Yes, the biggest thing I would say from reading is that it's a very much lower dopamine hit. It's because doom scrolling, every single time we hit that reel up, and I still do it. It's not me speaking on a high horse. Is that the right word? High horse? Speaking on a high horse. It's not high stool, right? High horse. Yeah. It's not about me speaking from a better standpoint of view, because I still do it. It's more like the cheap dopamine hits are just not good for you in a general sense. So, reading in itself that way, very good, right? Because you're entertaining yourself with a lower dopamine hit, better. But if you're not applying what you've learned, what is the point? And because all these self-improvement stuff, I remember the first time I was reading Atomic Habits, and I haven't read it back since, but I didn't take notes on it, and I didn't set myself goals to apply what I was learning from Atomic Habits. If you were to ask me, hey, what are 5 things you learned from Atomic Habits? I can maybe name you 2. One of them was, I remember but my point is, I'm not even going to go into naming 2 of them, but the overarching agenda is the fact that if we're not actually able to learn and apply what we're reading, you might as well just go on Instagram. Yeah, maybe, you might as well go on Instagram. The egotistical standpoint of reading a book every week just for it, there's not much to gain unless you apply. But I read The Almanac of Naval Ravikant, which is a banging book. And one thing I will say is, Naval Ravikant, if you don't know who he is, I don't know what to explain. Maybe just search him up. I don't know. But he basically explains that everyone should be reading every day. And there's four concepts he lays out. And I can't remember much exactly what it was, but I think it's philosophy, microeconomics, macroeconomics, mathematics, all these almost like those high school class subjects. He said you should be reading every day. And I go, hold on. Why? Why should we be reading it every day? And it's exactly for the fact that you're almost teaching yourself the ability to learn by reading those hard concepts every day. By picking up a science book, which is like, let's say for beginners, and you're just reading it, I don't know, 20 minutes a day, you're actually testing your brain to be going, hey, this is not like a doom scroll. This is not like an Instagram where you gain these cool scientific facts on Instagram where you scroll for a bit. It's like you got to do the hard stuff. And it's almost like that is like the mental puzzle of it. So when I said earlier, hey, what's the point of reading every day? I'm talking about self-improvement books in itself. Let's not spend that much time gassing ourselves up when we can spend that time learning. And maybe learning about concepts, rigid concepts, not like self-improvement concepts. Maybe this is hypocritical, especially that I have a self-improvement podcast. It can be more beneficial to read in order to increase and test your ability to learn information rather than just to give yourself a shit ton of information. Because if I read in Atomic Habits, hey, you should use a calendar, or I don't know, one of the tricks James Clear gives is, let's say you're starting, replace your bad habit with, you don't need to try to cut out a bad habit, but just replace it with a new one. But if you don't actually do it and you just know it, what's the point? But maybe when you're reading about math, which is a completely difficult subject, it's not the fact that you need to learn math, which is why it's good. It's the fact that you're making your brain learn how to learn new concepts. And that learning in itself is vital. So maybe this is a very weird take. Self-improvement books, some people love it, some people don't. I personally am on the side that I do like it. But what I will say is, when you're reading these self-improvement books, don't gas yourself up because you're reading one every week. If anything, you should gas yourself up when you're applying something that you've learned every week. It takes me a while to read a self-improvement book, because what I do is I take notes on it and I leave a sticky note and every single time I learned. And the reason it takes a while is because I'll try to apply whatever I learned and then I'll come back to the book. I'll only try to keep reading the book if I know that there's nothing to gain yet. But once I see a vital piece of information that I feel like I could apply to my life, hold on. I put the book down. Hold on, Rish. You gotta test this out. Because what's the point of learning all this garbage? Not garbage. These tips, if you're not going to try it out. So that's what I would suggest. And if you're going to read for the sake of, or even if you, let's say you're playing to doom scroll. Yeah, maybe it's a weird thing. I don't do it yet, so I'm not saying I've done it. But it may be cool to just pick up a random ass book like that teaches about a rigid concept, a concept that you don't know how to code, how to, I don't know, about like the history of philosophy, something like that, which just tests your ability to learn. Because realistically, that's what we should be optimizing for. And that's what Naval Ravikant says is one of the greatest skills to have, is our ability to learn. And Alex Hormozi says intelligence is your rate of learning and how you apply it. So yeah, that's my take. I don't know if I've said much there, but my overarching point is that overconsumption without anything or without applications mean nothing. And then when you're at least consuming hard concepts, it's not the consumption of these concepts that is good for you. It's rather the ability to know how to consume these hard concepts. So I'm not going to repeat. I feel like I'm going in circles, but that's mainly it. Fourth point is a tough one in itself again. No social media / no phone, basically digital detoxes. This one is tough. I did a whole episode with Richard Simon, who miraculously turned his phone off for a whole year somehow. And he basically explained that he prepared heavily for this detox. He told his friends, his family, saying, yo, buying a new shitty Nokia brick. You can reach me out at this number. I'm going to be doing it in a month for Sandpoint, so know that I'm doing it. I'm not airing you guys. And once he started doing it, he understood that suddenly, it's not like he just got this massive chunk of time that he'd be spent doom scrolling, but it's almost like you get this amount of time back through the accumulation of small moments where you would be using your phone. Whether he was at the zoo with his children and maybe sometimes you'd go on a business call for 5 minutes. That 5 minute span he can now give to his kids, and he'll take that call later when he comes back from home. Those are the moments that he felt like he was getting back. And for me, that is vital. I when I was on Opal is that app that restricts your screen time. And there was maybe a 2 week span where I was like, look, I'm literally going to try to use my phone for 30 minutes a day. Turned out my average screen time per week for that 2 weeks was 1 hour, which I was pretty gassed about. And a lot of it was to do with my YouTube analytics or like my Gmail stuff, which it's stuff that I'm still making an excuse for. But what I will say is when I didn't want to use my phone a lot, I realized that I was outside my house more, because sometimes the phones and these technology can keep us in the house just because when we have nothing to do, we're like, all right, screw it. Let's just watch something on our phones. But when I forced myself to go off, I was like, what the hell am I going to do? I can't go in my bed, doom scroll. I can't turn on the TV, go on the couch. I can't even watch, I don't know, golf and chess on YouTube on my laptop. Let me just go for a random stroll. And that random stroll, the first one, it was just like, what the hell am I doing? The second one, I'm like, all right, this is fine. But by the time you get like the 10th one, you're like, hold on. I know it's weird that you're lowering your standard, but you start getting dopamine from things that you normally wouldn't be getting dopamine from. And it's almost like your interactions, you want dopamine to come from almost every interaction you have with someone. So whether that's like being super outgoing with someone just because like you're so bored out of your mind when you're not with someone, that comes from removing these small cheap dopamine hits, which is your phone. But at the same time, it's annoying because the modern era also requires us to have a prominent digital presence. I'm not saying that's to start a YouTube channel or a podcast, but at least to be on Instagram, and when your network, like when someone sends you a new follow request, who is this person, you can reach out to them. It kind of requires that. And just like I'm doing now, it's almost like this is what I like doing, and it's a digital presence. But I think we all can agree in a general sense that a reduction of phone time and screen time is just better for us. We don't need to be on our phones as much as we normally are. And even when I'm looking at my notes now, and I was preparing for this solo pod. Sorry, it's not. I know I said it's not scripted, but there I still have a few notes. We'll go back on. I still was doom scrolling throughout it. Like, it's not like I'm like away from it, but I've just realized that you can be definitely more efficient, or the amount of times I use my phone is definitely not necessary. And I feel like maybe we should plan when we want to use our phone extensively, almost going, hey, like you can watch YouTube for 30 minutes. Like, okay, obviously people say don't use your phone before you go to sleep, but I still do that. So, hey, I was like, hey, Rish, if you want to use your phone 1 hour before you go to sleep, go for it for 30 minutes. Like, in that way. And I think that would be way more vital, because even when we're waiting for a train or a bus at a station, you don't really need to go on your phone. Like, you never know who you're going to run into. I was speaking to someone's parents the other day, and it's like, they met in the most random way, right? It's like, whether that's meeting at a bus station that you don't know, it's like, you don't know what's happening on the out. Like, the digital world can always wait a few minutes, but the physical world always passes right away. So, I don't know, whenever I've made an intentional reduction in my screen time, I've realized that I want more spontaneous things to happen in my life. And I feel like that's what we're supposed to be doing. I mean, just think about it. The average American spends 12 years of their life on their phone or on their screen. I mean, that's ridiculous. And I mean, I'm playing into it. 12 goddamn years. 12 years. And that's for the average American. Think about the generations as they pass, like as they keep on getting older. Because I probably got my first thing when I was 11, 12. I was an iPad kid as well. But people are going to be starting getting technology a lot sooner. So, Yeah. A reduction is needed. And I think a detox in itself, it doesn't need to be a year detox, like I said, Richard Simon. But if you can remove those small moments, I completely agree. Last one. Wow. We've come to a long time. This one is controversial, and it is sobriety. No alcohol. I'm talking about alcohol in itself. Unfortunately, I'm not a big drug guy, so I can't really speak on that, but I'll speak on alcohol. I maybe have a very weird take on alcohol, because I think the people around me typically don't monitor their alcohol usage as much as I do, not in a bad way. It's more just that, like, because I grew up in a household that doesn't consume alcohol, you become more aware of the times when there is alcohol in your presence. So, when it comes to alcohol and sobriety, I've developed two rules for when it comes to drinking. And I'm not saying these two rules are a must for everyone, I'm just saying it's for me. Because I'm just debunking my concept of sobriety. The two rules for me are, first, and both, by the way, it's like two conditions have to be met in order, so I'm allowed myself to have alcohol. Drink around people I trust. And the second is drinks are to enhance the experience, not to make the experience. So the first one, drink around people I trust. I've told myself I do not want to drink alcohol, especially with people I meet on the first time, because usually a lot of this anxiety that comes is when we feel like we acted stupid or we did something that wasn't ourselves. But when we drink with people we trust and know who we are when we're sober and know what our character is when we're sober, these stupid actions, they can be separated from the character because they already know who we are. When you drink with people that don't know you or that you typically don't trust that well, that's when this anxiety comes in, because it's almost like the first impression makes it. And if your first impression is you drunk and doing something stupid, it's hard for people to go, oh, that's not who he is because he was drunk. But it's hard to make that realization when you don't know someone when they're sober. So that's why when I meet people, I typically do not like drinking, at least for the first however long, until I know that we're tight, because then I don't need that anxiety when we drink. And also to make our life easier, oh, my phone's buzzing off. To make our lives easier, in case anything stupid happens, you're around people you trust, which is just 10 times better. So the second condition is drinks to enhance the experience and not make the experience. I have a lot of experience with this. I know I use the word experience a lot, but here we go. I think drinking in itself is okay when you don't want to, you don't need it, but rather you want it. And I know it's a very gray area, but I say this is like when you go into a night out and you go, hey, I need drinks in order to have a good time. That's when I would say don't have alcohol. But if it's more of like I would have a good time, but my night's going to be a 9 out of 10. It can be a 10 out of 10 if I have it. Indulge. It shouldn't be like, hey, it's going to be a below average night. Not below average, but it's one of those things that's hard to explain. But if it's not going to be a night that, if you're with people on a night out and it's more about the alcohol in itself rather than the people, for me, that's a bit of a red flag about, at least when it comes to drinking alcohol that night. I've never been a big fan of, like, social drinking anyway. That's just my opinion, but I know a lot of people do, and especially in Europe, where I grew up, social drinking is huge, whether you want to go to the pub, grab a pint. I mean, generally, though, Scott Galloway says that people start need to drinking more. That's just his take, especially with how Gen Z is doing, because Gen Z is probably, I think I might be wrong, is the first generation to actually reduce their alcohol consumption by nearly, I would say, I think 72%. I think there was a study that found half of Gen Z say that they don't drink, which is 72% down. Yeah, that's what it is, 72% down, which is huge, because Gen Z is very health focused now, and alcohol is just something that's not great for your health. But The statistics also show, and I'm not saying we're drawing a correlation, but this is why Scott Galloway is in what is inferring, is that because we're Gen Z is also less socially capable, which is probably due to technology, maybe part of COVID as well, the fact that maybe the world is so much easier nowadays that we don't need to gain dopamine from social situations, but rather other cheap dopamine hits. If you want to like get some sort of interaction from a girl who needs blood, who needs to step outside when you got the internet, it's almost stuff like that that makes us less socially capable. Scott Galloway, Professor Galloway at NYU, is arguing, hey, drinking can be a stimulant for social situations. You go grab a pint, guess what? You're leaving the house to be with others to grab a pint. And I don't see something, I don't see anything too wrong with that argument. I wouldn't completely agree. I think alcohol shouldn't be the main solution. It can be a side solution. What I will say though, when it comes to the health benefits of Gen Z, I think typically, and I play into this as well because I care about my health in itself. That's why people go to the gym. I will say though, I saw Matthew McConaughey said this, and it blew my mind in itself, that we're so obsessed with living longer that sometimes we forget that we need to live better. And I'm not saying that alcohol is a key to living better, but if my two conditions are being met, which is you can drink around people you trust, and as long as drinking is enhancing the experience, not making the experience, what is wrong from having an overall better experience? Because realistically, if you're going to say, this is my, I'm not making a complete argument as people who are dead sober, but I'm just saying, if you're going to step away from alcohol solely for the health benefits, then you better be that guy who goes, when I'm in a car, I'm putting on that seatbelt 100% of the time. Because you can work your ass off by eating clean, not drinking alcohol, going to the gym all the time, cold plunge, sauna, da 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 da, but you forget to put on a seatbelt, and then a car crash happens. Boom, all that hard work is gone. So it's one of those where just because you're prioritizing health in one facet, there's other facets that can also drain that or take that away. And sometimes it's okay to just live better than always focusing on living longer. Because sometimes living longer, as much as I say it is in our control, there's times when it's not. And I don't think there's a big, big issue with just saying, hey, I've done my piece, why don't I just live better for the night? You know? Like sometimes I feel like I'm always so focused, and I can't say I'm a genius or like I'm like a guru on this, but sometimes I am so focused on prioritizing the future reach that I forget about prioritizing the current reach. Like I'm only 20 at one point in my life, or I'm only 21 at one point in my life, and that's not for me to say, hey, I want to jump off a cliff all drunk and all that, but I'm just saying, if I'm constantly going to prioritize the future, when am I going to be able to enjoy the present? So that's it. So to recap on the drinking thing, I have two conditions, and I feel like they're two pretty good conditions, which is drink around the people you trust, and then drink in order to enhance the experience that is already good, but not to make it good in itself. So, wow, that was a pod in itself. I haven't done a solo pod in a while. I'm not even going to try to make cuts to it. But that is debunking self-improvement myths. Myths. I can't say the word properly, but myths. If we enjoy that, give the podcast 5 stars. If you're watching on YouTube, like it up, subscribe, do all that garbage. Otherwise, thanks for watching, people. See you later. That was cringe. I'll say that again. Thanks for watching. That was even cringer.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.